Welcome back to The Chain. I'm your host, Rory McCann, and I'm here with Senior Conference Director Kent Simmons. How's it going, Kent?
It's going really good today, Rory. How are things down there?
Great. We are back today with part two of your conversation with Dr. Kate Hasty of the La Jolla Institute for Immunology and Dr. Jamie Spangler of Johns Hopkins University. And for those of you listening, if you haven't already, go ahead and listen to the first half of their conversation in episode 11. Kent, last episode, your conversation was kind of an origin story. You discussed Kate and Jamie's careers, what they're doing now that they are so passionate about, and how they got started in science. I love stories like that because no matter where someone is in their own career, it's easy to find connection and identify with someone else's while also learning about the journey they took to get to where they are today. But in the second half of your conversation, you dig more into sort of the impediments to their success. And I found it interesting that they both seem to take a very collaborative and community-oriented approach to leadership and productivity that was inspired by their own mentors in the past. In science, you hear so much about competition and politics, and I find it refreshing to hear from two young, successful scientists who seem to model the idea that the rising tide lifts all boats. Now, what elements of the conversation were big takeaways for you?
I think the thing that's interesting for us with all the conference speakers we deal with is that we meet a lot of young scientists and we meet a lot of more established scientists, but we don't often get to understand what it's like to transition from one role to the other. And I think the thing that's been interesting in having these conversations with Kate and Jamie is that we've heard about the challenges that any younger established scientist would face in their projects. But I think we've also been able to hear from these two about what it's been like to take on a greater role in both projects and also working with a group of scientists who are coming up in their own careers. And I just think it's been really great to hear this in terms of advice for young scientists, like what can they think about as they come into the field, and what can they think about as they grow in the field. And it's really useful.
Yeah, that is so valuable to hear from young scientists mentoring young scientists. But I love how what they have to say about it really can have an impact no matter where people are in their careers. Let's get to it.
Kate and Jamie, I'd like to welcome you back to The Chain.
Good to be here. Thanks for having us, Kent.
So in the first part of our interview, we talked a little bit about the focus of your work with Kate developing vaccines and immunotherapies against the Lassa virus and Jamie's creation of new platforms for the development of targeted therapeutics to treat immune diseases. And it strikes me that those are both very complex worlds to live in day to day. And I wanted to just ask as a starting point for this part of the conversation, what do you feel are the most challenging aspects of your day-to-day work? And Kate, you had mentioned some new tools that you had in the last part of the podcast. And I wondered if you could start out and just talk to us a little bit about your challenges and maybe how some of these new resources have helped you.
Thanks, Kent. It's a continuous problem in science. And I think Jamie will agree that there's not enough hours in the day. So I'm still for sure very much at the bench. I love being at the bench and doing the research. So it can be really overwhelming, both planning the work as well as executing the actual research, managing the data, and also trying to be a good mentor for the next generation of scientists that are in the lab. And as you mentioned, we have a lot of new technologies, and they're definitely out of my normal wheelhouse of expertise. And so I've had to really actually go back to really basic relearning immunology that I took, as a class so many years ago, making an effort to go to conferences that I might not have otherwise a year ago, so that I can make sure that I'm up to date on the most relevant information that can propel my own work forward. For me in particular, I can get really lost in the details. So it makes it very difficult to see the forest for the trees. So I think putting myself in an environment that fosters a lot of dialogue to help define these big pictures has also been really important to keep those the day-to-day going.
Jamie, how about you? What are your big challenges every day?
Yeah, so Kate definitely defined the problem perfectly, that there is not enough time. And it really forces you to become a very, very strict time manager, but not just time manager, also a personnel manager. So in this role, as a principal investigator in a research lab, you have to do a lot of, you know, sort of meta thinking, right? So you have a lot of different projects going on in the lab. Some of them you directly have your hands on and are actively engaged in and are more on top of, or might be more in your wheelhouse, as Kate described. Some of them are outside of your wheelhouse and you have to delegate to some extent and be able to trust and manage the people that you are working with to sort of be the point people on that and to understand at some level, you know, how the experiments work and what the results and what the data mean, but also be comfortable with the fact that you are not the one that collected that data. You're not the one that's sort of, you know, intimately linked to it, and be able to, you know, still be comfortable managing your lab in that way. And so I think that really to have the maximal bandwidth, it's sort of a balance between, you know, sort of being present for everything, but then also letting go a little bit in terms of, you know, making sure that everything can get done as efficiently as possible. And that efficiency is also, you know, a big portion of the job, because you really have to look at the different strengths and weaknesses that other people have in your group. Everyone has strengths and has weaknesses, but being able to sort of position people in places where you know that they will succeed and thrive and maximally contribute without getting frustrated can often be a difficult challenge, but one that I think is a very important and powerful tool as a mentor to really discover what it is that excites and motivates each person in your lab and how to sort of maximize their success and productivity based on your understanding of their capability.
So you both talked about kind of planning and people and technologies and how those would influence the progression of your projects. And I'm wondering, as you look at your projects going out into the future and you try to plan a project and you encounter rate limiting steps, things that are going to have their own life and their own thoughts in the nature of science or the nature of a project, what do you each consider to be perhaps the biggest rate limiting steps, and what are your strategies for overcoming those? Kate, could you tell us a bit about yours?
Sure. In all science, it seems that there's not just one, but multiple rate limiting steps. So from a really purely research driven place in structural biology, which is our main technique we use, really looking at high resolution atomic detail at what these proteins, these viruses make, look like. It's all about the quality of the protein, right? And this can be a really major problem for some of these viral proteins we work with. So for example, the one that I have focused most of my career on is the only protein that the virus displays on the outside of its cell. And the job of this protein is to attach itself to the host cell and drive itself inside. Because to do its job, it has to be unstable and prone to changing its shape. This was a huge issue for many years, and it's the reason why it took us 10 years to figure out what it looked like. Now we know a lot more about how to coax these proteins into what we need them to be, to actually work with them and visualize them in whatever technique, whether it's X-ray crystallography or cryo-EM, or even in our antibody discovery platforms. It still can take sometimes months or even, you know, multiple years to achieve. And you have to keep on it and keep trying. And I wish I could say there was, you know, this grand plan that we go through. But one of the sayings in structural biology is, well, it depends on the protein. Every time we have a new postdoc or grad student start that isn't familiar with structural biology, this is the bane of their existence, that every protein has its unique characteristics that it, some are easy to work with, some are hard, and you're not quite sure what you're going to get until you start actually doing it. So really our plan is just perseverance, I think, to move projects forward.
Jamie, how about you and steps that might get in your way a little bit in the nature of this science?
Sure. No, I completely feel the backlog of protein expression. Every protein is its own special snowflake. You definitely don't want a blizzard. So know how that goes. Well, so my experience is, similar in terms of the nature of the limitations that we have. So the technology that my lab uses quite often is what's called directed evolution, where essentially you have some sort of base library of molecules or a starting molecule, and then you create a bunch of different variants. And through iterative rounds of selection, sort of like would go on, you know, in natural Darwinian selection, you try to pull out things that are, you know, have the particular function that you would want. And what's actually kind of the dirty secret about direct evolution is the evolutionary process is actually quite quick. What's actually the limiting step is then producing the new proteins that we generate, expressing those and characterizing them, and then understanding the biological mechanisms that they're affecting, right? Because when we pull something out of the library, sure, we know that it's generally, you know, binding or has some sort of readout, but we don't know how it's going to behave, right, in a full biological system. And so we have to actually express the protein, make sure it's folded properly, make sure that all of the biophysical characteristics and properties are consistent with what we would expect, and then actually characterize it in a biological or functional assay. And that for us tends to be the bottleneck a lot more than the selection and discovery and evolutionary process.
We hope you're enjoying this episode of The Chain and wanted to let you know about one of my favorite events coming this spring. The 16th annual PEGS conference is taking place May 4th through the 8th in Boston, Massachusetts. PEGS brings together a wide range of programs and topics from diverse perspectives that includes a mixture of industry and academic presentations, all centered around innovation, problem solving, and sharing ideas. You can save $100 on registration with the code POD100. That's POD100. Head over to PEGSUMMIT.com to learn more about PEGS, the Essential Protein Engineering and Cell Therapy Summit.
So those rate limiting steps are inherent in the nature of proteins. You have issues with expression and stability and the stages of directed evolution. You'll then take your work and go try to translate this into patients, and you'll confront many structures and situations and so forth in that effort. And I'm wondering what you see as the most major impediments to translating your research on a global scale. Maybe talking first about the world of viruses and your work, Kate.
Sure. So, you know, one aspect of our work is to identify where these really highly protective antibodies bind and try to turn them into therapeutics. But historically, antibody-based therapeutics are really expensive. You need a really high dose for treatment to be effective. So this can be a major impediment in the United States and Europe. And so it's only exacerbated by trying to use these therapies in developing countries like Africa. You know, not only are the cold chains maybe less reliable, but just the financial ability of these countries to pay for really expensive therapeutics is highly limited, particularly in these locations of high endemic Lassa and Ebola areas. So what we're really trying to do, and one of the major goals of our work, is to actually engineer the antibodies to be even more effective than nature was able to achieve, so that we can release this huge financial burden, increase the effectiveness of these antibodies by 100 or even 1,000 fold, so that every dose goes that much further, so that we can really be sure that these therapeutics are actually going to reach the vulnerable populations that we intend them to.
Jamie, how about you?
Yeah, so I would echo a lot of Kate's sort of thoughts about, you know, again, the distribution and affordability, you know, of antibody drugs. But for me, what I wanted to emphasize was really the sort of getting there, the bridge between, you know, having a molecule that we're excited about and actually getting that into people. And it's something that I'm increasingly becoming involved with as the technologies that we're developing are sort of coming of age. And one of the major roadblocks that I see is that, you know, sort of the requirements in terms of regulatory agencies, and not that that's, you know, necessarily like a barrier or anything like that, but the types of studies and confirmations that we need to do in order to make this into a viable drug are often a question that's no longer an academic question. Mm. A lot of this becomes something more that industry or even a company that you would outsource to commercially might take care of. But of course, you need the resources and finances, you know, to back that. And so it really involves sort of this liaising between, you know, sort of the academic and industry and potentially even startup companies and other sorts of commercial infrastructure to see the molecule through from sort of, as we like to say, you know, bench side to bedside, right? So through from making this in a research lab to actually being able to put this into a person. And so I think a lot of aspects of the biomanufacturing pipeline and sort of the downstream development, it really takes a lot of very careful thought and planning and resources to be able to do that, that won't necessarily all come from your lab or from an academic setting.
So these challenges are big. And one of you mentioned a little while ago that there weren't enough hours in the day to get through some of these. And I'm sure that the magnitude of your work is sometimes hard to deal with. And I wanted to ask, what kinds of strategies do you have for staying motivated day to day in the face of all of these challenges?
So, you know, working at the bench can be really isolating. And I think often scientists lose sight of the impact that their work might have on their field, or it's not immediately obvious, or they feel like they're repeating the same thing and they're not quite sure what purpose. And, you know, I'm thinking on like a more grander scale than to just answer the question. So I think, you know, really having a way to bring you kind of back to what that 20,000 foot view of your work is can be really grounding and really motivating to keep you going. So one of the most important experiences I had as a young graduate student was about in year two or three, and I had spent those two or three years having very little success of not even being able to see my protein expressed on a Western blot. It was really, really demoralizing. And I was fortunate to have a mentor to say, you know, come on, let's go to Sierra Leone. I'm going, come with me. And we're going to go and see the field sites. We're going to actually be in a region that is greatly impacted by Lassa. And I went there and I could meet survivors of Lassa. I could speak to them. I could talk to these healthcare workers that are there day in and day out caring for these patients. And being drawn back into that human side of my research was critical in keeping me going in the face of a lot of failure. So I came back really rejuvenated and able to just keep pushing through. And I would say the other thing that really helped was going to conferences, right? Is really strong motivator. Even if you have nothing to present, going and hearing new ideas, talking to other people, talking to scientists in your same field, outside of your field, at the same stage of your career, wherever that is, and beyond. And then also talking to younger scientists, because I think that really grounds you as well, has all been really instrumental in helping stay motivated, staying positive in a field, you know, that just all science in general can have more failures than successes, I think.
Jamie, what are your motivational tricks for yourself?
Yeah, so it's kind of funny. You take a lot of things sort of for granted when you're a graduate student. about your mentor, or your advisor, and then you become the mentor and you're like, wow, how did they do that? But I was always just literally astounded by the ability of my PhD mentor to just find the silver lining in anything, right? I would show him, you know, like an empty gel or a graph with like all zeros, and he'd be like, oh, but the experiment worked, right? Or, you know, but the negative control worked, or the positive, you know what I mean? Like, he would always find something, you know, to sort of keep you going that you had learned out of the experiment. And I think really there's a fundamental lesson there about extracting the positive about things, but also extracting as much information about every experiment that you do. Because now it's sort of, you know, the roles are reversed, and my students come to me and they're like, oh, you know, like they're all down in the dumps, and they're like, this didn't work. But I'll find something in there that did work, right? Or something that we will learn from that's maybe even more interesting than the question that we were asking in the first place. And so I think it's really just this hard-nosed optimism and also search and quest for finding information and finding success in sort of what you have in front of you. And the other thing that I would really, you know, highlight about, I think, you know, Kate already touched on, you know, having sort of patient interactions, patient advocates, and through a number of the grants and centers that I'm affiliated with, we have a lot of great interactions with people who are being affected by our therapies, which is very exciting. But also, yeah, just creating a network through conferences, through personal interactions, through collaborations, but different networks of people who are either at your career stage or in your field of interest, or sort of a community of peers to really bring fresh new ideas, sort of bounce off different feedback overall, just to kind of learn and grow together can be a really, really powerful thing.
I think it's been interesting as we've talked to hear both of you kind of describe both the perspective of being a young scientist coming into the field, and then also having the situation kind of flipped as you have evolved into your labs, where you're now managing and motivating people and serving as a mentor to postdocs and others in your groups. And as a closing question for you each today, could you share maybe a couple of other tips that you might give to young scientists who are maybe at an early point of their scientific exploration in school, and they're thinking about what to do with this, and maybe thinking about careers where they start to get into bigger projects and the translation of their work into the world? What would you recommend to these kids coming along today? Kate?
So I think, you know, I've touched on this a little bit, and certainly Jamie has as well, about perseverance, right? And failure is a huge part of science. And it's not that every failure is the end of the road. In fact, that idea of being able to take that blank Western blot and trying to learn something from it is a really important skill to have. And being able to find those silver linings, but also looking at your data and being one's harshest critic, I think is key as well, right? Being able to, you know, eventually your work is going to have to go through a peer review process, and being your first peer reviewer for yourself, I think is a great skill to start to foster early on, really that interrogation and interpretation. And how do you answer scientific questions? What is the scientific question? Being able to formulate those early in your career and really start to foster those skills, I think, are great foundations on which to build a career in science, no matter what your ultimate intended goal for a career is.
Jamie, what are your thoughts? Some quick tips?
Yeah. So a lot of times students at various levels will come to me and say, what does it take to, you know, get into your lab? What do I have to know? What do I have to do? What skills do I need to be strong in? And they're thinking I'm going to say like biochemistry or molecular biology or, you know, protein engineering, right? That I'm going to say like that. And I don't say any of that. I tell them the three C's that we like to say. The first is curiosity. And if they're coming to me, or if somebody's listening to this podcast, they probably already have that, right? Be curious about the world, ask questions, inquire, interrogate, demand to know more about the answers. Don't just take what you're given for granted. The second is commitment, which again echoes what Kate was saying about persistence, perseverance, fighting through in the face of challenges, but also just being fully committed to science and specifically in my case, you know, molecular engineering as not just, you know, something that you do, you know, for a few credit hours or to put on your CV, but something that you really care deeply about and you want to be an integral part of your life. And then the third is really, I think, the enabling aspect of any profession, not just in science, but communication. It's really important that not only you understand what you're doing, but that you're able to convey that properly to other people, whatever audience you may be talking to. And I think that, again, this is probably a lesson for sort of any field, but particularly in science, because the biology, the chemistry, the physics, right, all of it can be very overwhelming. There can be a lot of, especially in immunology, a lot of different acronyms and variables that you're talking about, and it can very quickly get jumbled up. And so just to really be able to distill that and package it in a way that other people can understand, and whether those people are your students in your lab, are, you know, speaking at a conference to a larger audience, or speaking to the general public, I think it's really, really important that you spend a lot of time and effort in honing and nurturing your communication skills.
Well, that's really great advice, I think, from both of you. I've been filling up a couple of pages here as we've talked, and there's a lot of very inspirational thoughts here, and I really appreciate both of you taking the time to join us on the chain. And I'll look forward to, I know I'm going to see you both at some conferences coming up, and I'll look forward to connecting with you in person sometime soon. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Kent. It was great.
Yeah, this was fantastic. See you soon.
All right, you guys. See you.
Thank you for joining us on The Chain. Tune in next time for more conversations about science, research, and exploring the world of protein engineering.